Welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Ron Newman, and he'll be answering your most important questions on Kamloops Rainbows, a fly fishing dream. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Ron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your message. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure to sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address on the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Ron Newman about Kamloops Rainbows. The Federation of Fly Fishers needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. It is involved in the Mangrove Recovery Initiative in Florida, in the Trout of the Desert Southwest Initiative to help the recovery of rare native trout, the Endangered Fisheries Initiative, and is helping to prevent the introduction of harmful aquatic species to new waters with their Clean Angling Pledge. The Federation won a National Conservation Award for its efforts. To continue this great work on behalf of all fly fishers, the Federation needs to increase its membership. It needs more concerned anglers willing to join in support of such projects, and by doing so, give something back to the sport that has given so much to each of us. Join the Federation of Fly Fishers today and help support their fine work. For more information on the Federation, visit www.fedflyfishers.org. That's fedflyfishers.org. Well, before we introduce Ron, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have two chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Ron's section that says, click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We will also be giving away a copy of Ron's book, Rainbow Trout Fly Fishing, courtesy of Amato Books. Amato Books is providing that as our gift tonight, our prize, and if you want to find out more about the books that Amato has, go to AmatoBooks.com, AmatoBooks.com, it's A-M-A-T-O, Books.com. So here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show, and the question's going to be something that Ron and I talk about during the show. You must submit your answer along with your name and your location in the text box on our homepage. So listen closely and use your best typing skills, and maybe you'll win Ron's book. Tonight our guest is Ron Newman. Ron has been fly fishing since he was 2 years old. Well, let's say fishing since he was 2 years old. He obtained a Bachelor of Science degree from Northern Arizona University and then moved to British Columbia, where he worked for the British Columbia Forest Service. In 1971, Ron was extremely fortunate when his job took him to Kamloops and placed him right in the middle of world-class fly fishery. By 1973, he had discarded other forms of angling to pursue the famous Kamloops trout with a fly rod. As Ron was beginning to fly fish, he began keeping detailed records of each fishing trip so that he could fish the same hatches in subsequent years. His computer now holds more than 970 detailed records of fishing trips. He has analyzed that data to determine how such things as weather conditions, water conditions, moon position, fish and bug activity, and numerous other factors might affect his fishing success. Ron has now invested more than 30 years finding the answers to questions such as how well do rainbow trout see, hear, and smell, or how important is color to the angler and what is the lateral line used for. After all the years of research and data analysis, Ron finally wrote a book to pass along this information to other anglers. The book is entitled Rainbow Trout Fly Fishing, A Guide for Still Waters. It is directed at the intermediate to advanced angler who wants more than a new fly pattern or an interesting fishing story. The book was released in 2008 by Frank Amato Publications. Ron has been a member of the Kamloops Fly Fishers Association and the British Columbia Federation of Fly Fishers since 1974. Ron, welcome to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Thank you, Roger.
Well, good to have you tonight. Is it getting chilly up there in B.C. now?
We're hitting freezing temperatures most every night now.
Yeah. So are we up here in the Rockies. So I, at 8,800 feet, it's probably about where you are in northern latitude. So I think it's about the same thing. But today was a beautiful day. I had the doors and windows open, so a wonderful day in Colorado. Anyway, let's get digging on these Kamloops rainbows. And also, I just wanted everybody to know tonight that a lot of the techniques that Ron's going to talk about here, I believe, apply to still waters and rainbow trout just about anywhere. I don't think it has to be a Kamloops. So there's a lot to learn from Ron and what his studies have done. But his right in the heart of these beautiful fish. And so, Ron, let's learn a little bit about the Kamloops rainbow first of all, and then we'll dive into who they are and what they do and how they act and all that stuff. So what is a Kamloops rainbow?
You have to understand the history of these things a little bit. People have often asked, is there a Kamloops trout? And the answer is both yes and no. It all started back in the 1800s when people started talking about the fantastic fishing around the Kamloops area. And by the late 1800s, some samples were sent to a Dr. Jordan at Stanford University, and he examined these fish and found out they, in fact, were physically different. They had more rows of scales, fewer gill rakers, fewer rays or bones in the dorsal and anal fins, and fewer of those marks, the branchial rays, the little lines under the throat. And so he examined all this and said, yes, these trout are in fact different than the normal rainbow trout. And as time went on, another guy, a Dr. Motley, began to study the rainbows, and he found out that in fact, no, they're not different from the normal rainbow trout.
Sounds like the global warming issue.
Oh, it does, yeah. Dr. Jordan, in fact, even given them a scientific name. I think they were called Salmo Kamloopsii. But after Motley's work, later in the century, in about 1931, I think, he discovered that all these differences in the physical attributes of the fish were due to the environmental conditions. They weren't genetic differences. And one of the primary things was that the streams around here are about 9 degrees cooler than the normal streams that rainbow trout reproduce in. And he took a batch of eggs from one fish, raised them at temperatures that were 9 degrees cooler than the average and at the average temperature. And the ones that were raised at the 9 degrees warmer did not develop into Kamloops trout, even though they were from the same fish. Whereas the ones that were raised in cooler temperatures developed all the characteristics of the Kamloops. So the answer is yes and no. There are Kamloops trout that are physically different. They have extreme fighting capabilities and stamina characteristics. But you can't transport them away from Kamloops.
So they've tried to introduce them into other waters? And
they've transferred some down to California and other places. And unless those locations have very similar conditions to Kamloops, they just do not develop the same characteristics.
It seems every time I see a picture of a Kamloops rainbow, it is just a gorgeous fish. I mean, I don't know what it is. I mean, silver, the coloring of it, they always look so pretty. And I don't know if it's just that they are or what makes it that way. Is that, do you find the same thing?
Yeah, one of the things that Dr. Jordan noticed were that they have a brighter orange fin coloration, more like a brook trout. They get that bright orange on the underside of their fins, and their camouflage spots are more distinct, and there's fewer of them, and their head's a little wider and longer than the normal rainbow. And, yeah, they're a very beautiful fish.
Yes, yeah.
You get them gleaming in the sunlight, that you can see that real orange color on the fins.
Yeah, and very silvery. I mean, they just kind of glow to me. Murray in Nova Scotia, on the other side of Canada, asks, is there any real difference, and he's got real in capital letters, real difference in Kamloops rainbows and rainbows from anywhere else in Canada. So I guess based upon what you just said, could they exist at the same latitude in cool waters up there in Canada?
A lot of Canada has another thing that was happening with these fish when they were growing after the eggs were, you know, laid and hatched, is that the water around here gets a lot warmer. And so the warmer water also provides faster growth rates and large quantities of food. Most of the rest of the Canada doesn't get that. We're almost a desert condition here.
So that contributes to conditions that don't exist anywhere else. So, again, the answer is Kamloops rainbows are in Kamloops and nowhere else.
Pretty well.
Yeah, yeah.
Like I say, there are physical differences, but not genetic differences.
Mm-hmm. But the conditions.
Comparing steelhead and rainbow trout.
Yeah.
Typically, they're the same fish, but one goes to the ocean, one doesn't.
And they look and they end up quite different. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we know we find them up in the Kamloops area. Where is Kamloops? You know, we've got international listeners here, and not everybody may know where that is. You want to give a little geography lesson here for us?
We're about a 3 hours drive northeast of Vancouver, B.C., which is just north of Seattle a bit, Seattle, Washington.
Okay.
We're in the southern interior. We're west of the Rocky Mountains, but not to the coast mountain. We're sort of a big trench over here that's, like I say,
here in between.
Sagebrush and a little bit of cactus growing and this kind of stuff.
So, yeah, so you're not getting the coastal moisture and so forth like
you. No, most of the moisture is dropped before it gets into our area.
Right, right.
Very little rainfalls.
Okay. How big do the Kamloops rainbows get? What's a good-sized trophy fish up there?
Well, back when Dr. Jordan was first examining these things, there was rumors of fish that were 33 to 55 pounds.
Oh, my gosh. They're
supposed to be averaging 10 pounds. But we don't have that anymore. The lakes of food supplies have dwindled and this kind of stuff. The biggest I've seen is about 18 pounds.
Okay. That's still a nice fish.
Yeah. What you can expect is most of the fish will be in the one-pound category, probably about half the fish. And then they keep getting fewer fish as they get larger. And by the time if you want a five-pound-plus fish, it'll be less than one fish in 100.
Hmm. Yeah, I noticed that in your book. In fact, we were talking about this before the show. You have a graph in your book that shows the numbers of fish at certain sizes and kind of the bell curve that creates, right?
Yes. The fish are stocked and they start growing in the lake. After about a year, they're 1 pound. After 2 years, about 2 pounds and so forth. After 5 years, 5 pounds. And they don't tend to live much longer than that. So average of growth, about a pound a year. And meanwhile, the number of fish in the lake are being reduced by angler mortality and loons and other predators and natural death and whatever. And you lose about 60% of your fish each year. So by the time you're up to the five-year-old fish, there's only just a very few of them left.
And what is in a normal lake like that with natural reproduction and so forth and not being stocked? Where would you normally find the most fish? What size range would you find the most fish?
Most of our lakes are stocked lakes.
Oh, okay.
We're fairly well landlocked. Don't have permanent streams, you know, with our dry conditions going down to the major rivers and major waterways. And so they get stocked, and that way the fisheries managers, like Brian Chan, can control the numbers of fish fairly accurately based on the food chains in the lake and this kind of stuff.
Okay. So that kind of skews the sizing as compared to a natural lake, is what you're saying.
The lakes that we have there have natural spawning in them. We tend to get too many fish, and they don't grow very big.
Ah, too much competition, huh?
Too much competition.
Yeah. Now, Heather Trimble in Cambria, California, wanted to know how to tell a difference between a female and a male trout.
Until they reach the spawning stage, I'm not really sure.
It's hard to tell, huh, with the rainbows?
I know some of the guys that I fish with say, oh, that's a male and that's a female, but I've never been able to tell the difference for sure until they become spawners.
Hmm. And you've seen a lot of them, that's for sure. And what size do they have to be to spawn?
It's not so much size as age.
Okay.
And when they're reaching 4 or 5 years old, that's when they go into their spawning cycle because they're nearing the end of their life cycle. And again, in a lake that has lots of fish, the fish aren't going to be very big. Whereas the lake that has fewer fish, they could be 5 to 10 pounds.
Okay, okay. So that last couple of years of their life is their prime time to reproduce?
That's when they go in the spawning cycle, yes. Hmm. There's some what they call precocious males that think they're sexually mature but actually aren't, and they might go into the spawning cycle at 2 or 3 years old.
And males are always like that, aren't they?
Yeah.
too ready. So that was kind of a question I had is, you know, when you catch a big trophy fish like that, you know, some people have said, oh, well, he's going to die in a year anyway, you know. So a lot of people end up keeping fish like that. But really what you're telling me is for natural reproduction, that's not a good thing to do, I guess. Huh?
Well, again, most of our lakes are stocked, so it's not so much the natural reproduction.
Yeah, but I mean, let's say we're in a lake that does have the natural reproduction. That,
well, again, we tend to get too many fish, and you don't get the
big ones anyway, no?
Fish.
So, interesting, because, well, you said way back when there were some really big fish. Were they stocking back then, too?
No.
No.
Okay, most of the fly fishing is done in the smaller lakes around the area.
Oh.
As Brian Chai was calling them, the eutrophic lakes, the geologically older lakes.
Okay.
And the big lakes, the main stem lakes, like Kamloops Lake and Shuswap Lake and so forth, there's still some rainbows in there that might hit into the 20-pound categories.
But those are bigger lakes and harder to reach with a fly rod, is what you're saying.
Kamloops Lake is 580 feet deep, and if they're down deep, you're not going to get to them with a fly rod.
No. Okay. Can you talk about, and I know you spent a lot of time in your book, but maybe you can kind of hit the high points here. Can you talk about the sensory perceptions of the trout and how they might affect us as anglers?
Okay. First of all, the trout has a very small brain. It's not much more than just an enlargement of the spinal column. They're not very smart. And most of that brain is devoted to their sense of smell. And salmon and steelhead and so forth, apparently they use the sense of smell to get back to their spawning areas. And that's one of the reasons so much of the brain is devoted to that sense. And for the anglers, like I say, these fish can smell really well. If you look at the nose on a trout, you see the two little holes. But if you look really close, there's a flap on each of those holes. So they have as water goes in, one flap's open, and as it goes out, the other flap's open. So they have a two-chamber smelling system. And apparently those are really excellent sniffers, if you like. And
so it's more of a channel than it is?
Yeah, it goes in and circulates, and it really increases their sense of smell.
Hmm. Interesting. Hmm. Never knew that. Yeah.
So trout can smell really well in water, and one of the things this means to the angler is wash your hands before you fish, or even before you tie your flies. All mammals have a substance in their skin called elserin. And that substance, if you don't wash your hands, can get onto your fly, and it tends to frighten or spook the fish.
So when you're saying wash your hands, are you talking about wash your hands in lake water with no soap, I would assume?
Huh? Before I tie on my flies, I tend to rinse them off in the lake water and then tie on my fly.
Okay.
When I'm tying flies at home and then the fly tying bench, wash them before I start handling the materials.
Okay, just to try to get that chemical that you had mentioned,
yes.
Is that an oil type?
It's sort of an oil thing.
Okay.
Apparently in the streams, if you wade in barefooted upstream of a trout, he'll take off because you can smell the elserin washing off your feet kind of thing.
Huh.
It actually spooks the fish.
Okay.
They're sensitive to this because bears and other mammals are predators on the fish, and they smell this, and then they run away.
Okay.
Eyesight. Rainbow trout have average eyesight. But they can see in binocular and monocular vision both ways. They prefer to feed by sight. And as they're making their final approach on your fly or a bug, they tend to turn and face it where they can get both eyes looking at it to find out the distance away from it. And the way their eyes are structured, they can actually see almost 360 degrees around their body. They have a small blind spot right directly below them and right directly behind them. But when they're swimming and they're going through that undulating motion, that pretty well reduces that blind spot. Like I say, they can see all the way around them.
How does that affect the fly fishers as far as at certain depths? I mean, can they not see us at a certain depth? For instance, if they're 10 feet down, do they have no recognition of predators?
Well, as light goes down in water, it tends to get absorbed by the water. And we'll probably discuss colors later on, but the color red, for example, in very clear water will disappear within about 3 feet. That actually turns to a gray tone. So, like your fishing lures, they're red and white a lot of times. And
then contrast, right?
Yeah. When it gets down deep in the water, that actually turns red and gray. White and gray. And the red tone disappears.
Okay. What I was thinking is more, you know, if a trout is, at what depth can they not see us anymore? We know when we're fishing in streams, they can see us really readily, you know.
Yeah, well, most of the streams are shallow enough they can see you. In lakes, well, a lot of it depends upon the clarity of the water, the time of day, You know, if you got murky water, the fish can't see but a couple of feet.
Okay.
If you're fishing at nighttime, again, they can see quite well by starlight, but not any distance. They can see up to about 15 feet. After that, their eyes are constructed in such a manner that they just can't see very well. They should have glasses on after that.
Right. Okay. So you have less to worry about spooking trout than unless you're in shallow lake water.
In terms of them seeing you, yes.
Yeah.
But to compensate for that, like in cloudy water or at nighttime or whatever, the fish's lateral line, that locates low-frequency vibrations in the water. And it's located around the head as well as down the side of the fish. I mean, most people think of the lateral line as just that line down the side of the fish. But most of their lateral lines are actually located in their head. And it's on both sides of the head so they can tell which direction vibrations are coming from. And when their eyesight can't be used, they can actually locate food and anything moving in the water by their lateral line.
So what you're saying is basically if you're going to be doing any wading in the lake or paddling around in your float tube, then you've got to be even more conscious about that activity than being seen necessarily.
Yes. I can't confirm this because the scientific papers I've read on their lateral line says it's only good for anything from a few centimeters to a meter or two. But I have watched a fish take a fly at over 100 feet away. He just zoomed right into it, and there was no way he could possibly know that fly was exactly there except by the vibrations it put off from this and gave to his lateral line.
Hmm.
But like I say, I differ from the scientists a little bit on this. I think it's accurate for quite a distance. I mean, the whales use their lateral low-frequency vibrations for
right. Communications
over hundreds of miles.
Right, right.
And I think that the lateral line will actually assist the fish in feeding at quite some distance.
Well, we need to take a quick break here, Ron. But when we come back, we'll talk more with Ron Newman about Kamloops Rainbows. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at frontrangeanglers.com. That's frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Ron Newman about Kamloops Rainbows. If you'd like to ask Ron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, Greg Simpson in South Dakota asks, how do Kamloops do in competition with other trout? Do they tend to do well in waters with lake trout?
In those type of waters, they do fairly well, yes. Where they have some problems with other species of fish is like perch and bluegill, for example. Those types of fish are much better at foraging out insects than the trout are. So what happens is trout will feed on insects really small, but once they get to be about 16 inches or so, they'll start feeding on minnows and so forth in that lake. In most of our lakes around Kamloops, we don't have those kind of fish in the system. It's just strictly rainbows. And so what happens is the fish remain insectivorous. They feed on insects right through their life. They never go to the stage where they're feeding on minnows. So
no cannibalism going on there.
No cannibalism and this kind of stuff. Your biggest fish will even feed on the smallest little insects, whereas in the bigger lakes where there's other species of fish, they tend to go to become minnow feeders.
Right. Right. Let's talk about still waters here for a bit, about the lakes themselves. Are some lakes better than others for rainbow trout?
It depends upon the type of fishing you want to do. If you're interested in lots of fish, you know, take the kids out fishing, this kind of thing, there are certain lakes for that. If you're interested in catching that big trophy trout, there's other lakes that are better for that. In terms of fly fishing, again, we take the smaller lakes in the area rather than the great big main stem lakes.
Okay, so the big main stem lakes is where you're going to catch them trolling or something
yes.
like that.
And,
yeah, as opposed to fly fishing. But the lakes themselves, do the larger lakes grow larger fish?
I mean, they tend to, yes.
Okay.
Although I've Little Lake I took a friend to. He caught a 10-pound, 1-ouncer on Little Lake that if you threw a stone twice, you could be have it thrown across the lake.
Wow.
So it's just a small little lake, and our lakes will produce fish that size.
Okay, okay. What are some of the important things that we need to know about lakes as fly fishers? You know, if we're going out to a new lake to try to determine whether it holds good fish or is a healthy lake, is there some things that we would need to know about that?
I think most of the lake basics, your interview with Brian Chan, I believe he covered a lot of this stuff on lakes. But in terms of deciding which lake to go to, if you're not familiar with the area, what I recommend to people is check the fishing regulations. And any lake that has a special regulation on it tends to produce bigger fish. That's one of the ways of finding the lakes that have the bigger fish in them.
Okay. Okay. When we have Thomas in Redmond, Washington ask, how does seasonality affect stillwater trout fishing compared to rivers? What factors are involved? Just water temperature or flow?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of things involved in seasonality. Weather, number of fish in the lake, again, whether they're natural stocking, this kind of stuff. The water conditions, of course, hatches. October is probably one of our best months for catching fish. But, I mean, both lakes and rivers fish in different seasons. So like I say, late fall is probably the best for fishing the lakes around here.
Okay. Now, I think he was getting at, you know, when compared to one another, does weather affect both types of water similarly? In other words, if a store low pressure zone comes in or something like that?
Okay. Data I've collected over the years is directed specifically at still waters. So
okay.
I can't say for sure that it affects the streams in the same way.
Okay.
I know that, like using the lateral line in Hearing, for example, it doesn't work in a stream. Part of it is all the stream running makes all this ambient noise, so the trout can't hear as well. Whereas you don't get that in a lake. You get different problems, motorboats and this kind of thing.
Right, right. But, yeah, there's that constant sound in the stream. I mean,
yes.
Even as fly fishers on the surface, we can't talk to each other if we're more than 30 feet away, you know.
It's right.
Well, tell us a little bit about the weather conditions that, as fly fishers, we should be concerned about or be aware of and how it affects the fishing quality or the feeding.
Well, over the years, every time I've gone out, I've collected information on how good the fishing was and what the weather was like and what the water was like and this kind of stuff. And what I essentially found out was that our predominant winds are from the west or southwest. And when those winds are coming through, it's usually the best fishing. If the winds are from the east or northeast, worse fishing. If you don't have any wind at all, a calm lake surface, usually terrible fishing.
What do you think that's got? I mean, why is that?
Well, it's part of the sensory perception of the fish again. Trout don't have eyelids. I don't know if you ever think about that, but they can't close your eyes. And on a bright sunny day, to be out in shallow water feeding, sun shining down, and it hurts their eyes. So they tend to come when there's cloud cover. Actually, overcast days are one of the best times to fish. I've also found if there's a light breeze, it disturbs that surface somewhat, and the light doesn't penetrate nearly as much to hurt their eyes, and that's one of the better times to fish.
More of the almost the dusk or night effect going on there.
Actually, in the evening, as the sun's going down, fishing's about 30% better than it is during the daytime.
Yeah. And I've noticed that on the little lake that I have here by my house. I mean, most of the time I don't go down there until 2 hours before sunset because it's just so much better fishing at that time than any other time. And if you can stand to stay out there in the dark, then that's when you're going to catch the really, you know, the larger fish. So now, yeah, so any kind of low light level is going to help.
Low light level's best, yes.
Now, you said wind direction. So if people are trying to use the same information in their area, they're going to have to kind of keep records, too, as to, I mean, just because it works for you there doesn't mean it's going to work somewhere else as far as direction.
Certainly
so.
Not.
Yeah.
But I think at least in the western part of the states and Canada here, most of our storms come up from the west and move east.
Okay.
And I would think it would generally apply. If your predominant winds come from the west, then, yeah, that's probably the best time to go fishing.
Now, is there anything to the, you know, you hear this a lot about you know, when the wind's blowing from one direction, if you go to the far side of the lake, that it's always better fishing because the insects or the bait fish or whatever blows down and the fish follow. Is that what you found too, or?
I haven't found that.
Oh, okay.
I have been on a shoal where the wind blows over the shoal and it blows bugs to the downwind side, and had better fishing on that side of a shoal than I have on the upwind side. But well, I fish out of a canoe, and a lot of times I'll, when the wind's blowing, I'll get to the upwind side of the lake and fish there, and never seen any difference in terms of the success ratio.
Yeah, you don't see the... But you're talking about fish that are feeding primarily on insects in your
yes.
area, too.
Yes.
I suppose if wind was blowing bait fish one direction, fishing might get better on the other side, but...
It's not likely it would, I don't think. I mean, bait fish are down under the water, so it probably wouldn't affect them.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing I have noticed with, you would think the more bugs you see on the surface of the lake, the better the fishing. It hasn't worked out that way. When there's a few to very few bugs, actually seems to be a better time to fish.
And why do you think that is?
When you get, like, you get out in a major chironomid hatch, and there's millions of chironomids hatching, you throw your fly out there, and if there's anything wrong with it, why would the fish take that when they've got all these other chironomids to select from? That's my theory on it.
Okay, okay.
Whether it's true or not, I'd like to say I'm not positive, but that's my theory on it.
What are some of the behavioral traits of trout in still waters that we should be aware of? What are they doing down there?
Again, most of our fish are, at least in the fly fishing lake, are hatchery fish. When they come out of the hatchery, they're put in the lake, and they haven't got a clue what's going on there. And they've been fed pellets or whatever all their life, right? So they've got to learn what to eat, what not to eat, and they don't know when the hatches are going to occur. And it's after they've been in the lake a few years that they learn all this stuff. And after a while, they can actually forecast when a hatch is going to happen. They have biological clocks. They can say around about June 3rd, there's going to be a sedge hatch or a caddis hatch. They seem to know when these things are coming on. Competition, another thing in between fish. Smaller fish have to feed about once a day or every 2 days. And some of your larger fish, when you get up to a 5-pound fish, then they can go several weeks without feeding. So, again, that's one of the reasons you catch more of the smaller fish than you do with the bigger fish.
They're just more active out there, right?
They're more active, yes. Because of their metabolism, they need to feed more often than a big fish just to maintain their weight, much less put on growth. And fish have the ability to learn, you know, like I say, when they come out of the hatchery and stuff. And they'll even learn ways to avoid the angler. A lot of people practice catch and release now. And you catch fish and you throw them back. Next week, somebody comes along with a fly that's identical to the one that he just took and got caught on. He probably won't take it again. The fish become fly shy. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Some of my biggest fish have been caught on unusual flies. Not the standard run-of-the-mill fly.
Yeah, just because they aren't used to seeing it, huh?
Right, right.
Something different, yeah.
What I call rise lines. Sometimes you see surface activity on the lake, and there's fishing over here, and there's not fish over there on the surface. I always fish where the fish are active on the surface. There might be certain environmental conditions, a certain hatch, that the fish are attracted to in that one location, and they may not be feeding anywhere else on the lake.
Scott from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, says, do these fish school or do they roam around independently?
The small ones tend to school. It's sort of a thing for protection. Particularly little minnows, you watch those in the lake and they're in a big school, right? As they get older and older and older, they tend to form smaller and smaller schools. And sometimes it's just a large group. So again, that might be where a rise line is, where a group of fish are. By the time they get to be fairly big, they're often singular fish, or they might have a small hunting pack, you know, two or three fish that hunt together, but often just singular fish when they get bigger.
Ron in Amarillo, Texas asks, what's the biggest factor that produces large trout in lakes?
Lots of food. Our lakes are quite productive, and the more food we get, the faster the fish grow, and the only thing that's limiting them is their age.
Hmm. Okay. Just a lot, in your case, a lot of bugs, because they're not eating minnows, so
yep.
A lot of bugs.
Yep.
So where's, you know, when we're looking at a lake, where's the best place to look for the fish? You mentioned those rise lines. That's a good indicator.
Watch for the rise lines is one of the first things I do. But just in general location, where do you even start before you're looking for rise lines? About 80% of the fish's food, maybe 90%, is located over the shoals, and that's where they come up to fish. Over the years, I kept tracking. 50% of my fish were caught over the shoals, and another 30% at the drop-off. Only about 20% of the fish are out deeper. And so they come up to these shoals to feed. But when they finish feeding, they need to go someplace and rest and digest their food. And they usually go down to a deep water to do that, where it's cooler. And so one of the best locations is where you got a good feeding shoal, and nearby you have a deep hole where they can go down deep and rest.
But in this case, when you're trying to catch a fish, deeper is not better.
No, you try to get them when they're on the shoal, when they're up for feeding.
Yeah, they're not interested when they're down there taking their nap after their lunch, kind of, so to speak. Yeah.
Middle of the summer, when the lakes get warmer, you might go down deep. But most of our fly fishing is done in, I'd say, 20 feet of water or less.
Okay.
We don't normally fish the real deep areas.
Let's talk about equipment then for a few minutes, since we're talking about water depth and so forth. Kelly in Colorado asks, give us your thoughts about density compensated sink lines. Do you use them? Are you using sinking lines?
I'm not a very good person to ask on equipment.
Okay.
I had my graphite fly rods for about 30 some odd years and so forth. But the favorite lines that I use, and I think I heard Brian Chan say the same thing, was an intermediate sink, which I often call a slow sink, and a dry line. Two favorite lines.
Yeah, I found that to be good too. Yeah.
The high density lines, use them on occasion. When, like I say, midsummer, when the fish are down real deep, I might use them then. But other than that, not very often.
Okay. Jesus in Spain asks, can you give us some examples of leader and different lines that you use? So basically, you know, leader setups that you're using. Anything specific? Like for chironomids, are you doing something different than?
No, I use the same leader, whether it's a sinking line or a floating line.
Okay.
And what I use is I build my own leaders. I'll take a short section of 12-pound test, a short section of 10-pound test, and from there I go to 8, 6. I usually don't go below 6 with the bigger fish around here. And I'll build myself 20-foot leader, and that's primarily what I use.
Okay.
On the sinking lines, I keep my leader down to maybe 10 feet. On the dry line, I'll usually go a long leader with it.
Okay. We got a few more questions about leader and so forth, but let's take a quick break, and then we'll continue and talk a little bit more about that, and then talk about food and flies here in the lake. Royal Gorge Anglers is a full-service fly shop on the Arkansas River in Canyon City, Colorado. They provide both walk, wade, and float fishing guide service on the Arkansas, South Platte, and several private high country ranches. They specialize in fly fishing education and work to assure that everyone taking a trip leaves being a better fly fisher. For the best service and the most fun in the Southern Rockies, visit the folks at Royal Gorge Anglers, the gateway to Southern Colorado. Located conveniently on U.S. 50, only 45 minutes from Colorado Springs. For more information, visit their website at www.royalgorgeanglers.com. That's www.royalgorgeanglers.com. Or call them at 888-994-6743. That's 888-994-6743. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Ron Newman about Kamloops Rainbow, a fly fishing dream. If you'd like to ask Ron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We receive it immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Okay, a couple more questions from our listeners, and you may have already answered this, but John in Pontiac, Illinois, asks about the most useful rig for fishing midge pupa relatively deep, let's say 10, 20 feet deep.
Yeah, well, that's normally where we're fishing them anyhow.
Okay.
From 2 or 3 feet right down to about 20 feet. I tend to weight my flies, like you tie up a chironomid or midges, a lot of people call them, put weighting in there that helps the fly sink. And I'll have a 20-foot leader on a dry line and fish it in about 15 foot of water and very slowly retrieve it. If you don't get a very small chironomid and you can't get much weight on it, some of the guys around here will take and use a They'll tie a swivel onto their leader. It helps us go down faster. I tend to, because I build my own leaders and I've got knots in it, I use something called deep soft weight. It's almost like a lead putty. It's okay. Not actually lead, but you put that on the leader and it'll take it down faster. And you can get it right down near the bottom. Most of the fish are usually feeding within a couple of feet of the bottom, but not always. I was on Tunkville Lake one time, and I put on the lake's only 18 feet deep at the deepest point, and I put on my 23-foot leader, and I was fishing right down near the bottom, and all these fish were rising, and I wasn't getting a strike. And finally it dawned on me, a little light bulb went on overhead. I'm fishing on the bottom, the fish are rising on the surface. I shortened my leader down to about 2 feet, and I started catching all kinds of fish. It pays to change your leader length sometimes if something like that is happening.
Now, were those midges that they were feeding on at the surface?
Yes, yes.
Okay, so it was the same fly, just depth.
Yeah, it was the depth that was the difference.
Okay. Dennis Johnson in Northern California asked, he says, what's the deal on the new sliding indicator? Are you using those?
I don't use indicators. I'm one of the old-fashioned guys.
Okay.
But if I use the commercial leader, or it makes it hard to switch between your change your leader length, the sliding indicator would be one of the great things, because you say you might want to fish at 2 feet depth, or you might want to fish at 20 foot depth, and to slide your indicator back and forth to get that depth off of your leader is a great thing.
Yeah, I think, I'm not sure that's what he's asking about. He might be also asking about, I think they have these indicators that release. You know what I'm talking? You don't fish with them. So.
I don't fish with them.
I think
a lot of guys do here, and they work really well for them for adjusting their depth. But
yeah, it's one of those things where you've got, you know, that 23-foot leader, and you stick an indicator on there, and if it's solid on there, then when you catch a fish, you can't get the fish in. So
It
gets stuck. So somehow there's release, and so the line can go through the guides, and you can get that fish in and net it. So
it's one of the things I pop it into your computer on your browser and look it up. There will be on there, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Gene Brown in Hillsboro, Oregon asks, when do you use fluorocarbon tippets? Only with nymphs or with everything, if at all, and why? What is the secret to getting the knot break?
Go the knot breaking first. While you're casting, you got to watch to make sure you don't get any wind knots or casting knots into your leader. What causes the leaders to break is it like just an old granny knot in your leader. It cuts on itself, and it'll break it with a small fish. As for the fluorocarbon tippets, I don't use them because, again, I'm building my own leaders. I'm not going to push a brand name, but I use it. You don't want a leader that's going to stretch. You don't want one that's going to twist easily and this kind of stuff. You don't want one that holds a memory. And I use Maxima. Like I say, I don't know if I'm supposed to brand names or whatever. But
that's fine.
I use that because it doesn't do any of those things. It doesn't stretch. It doesn't hold a memory. You'd run it over your pant leg, and it becomes straight as anything. And you can't have a coil in your leader. If you're fishing nymph in particular and you've got a coil in your leader, when you get a strike, and sometimes they're very, very soft strikes, that coil will act like a spring, and you won't even see your line move or your indicator move or anything else. You need to have a straight leader.
Do you have any tricks for straightening that out? Let's say you don't.
I run all 20-foot leader over my pant leg, and it straightens it out.
Sometimes kind of heats it up?
A piece of rubber or a leather cloth, and they just run it up the length of the leader to straighten it out.
So that kind of heats the...
You got to be careful not heating it up, yeah. You see, over my pant leg, I'm sure I'm not getting it too hot.
Yeah.
But that's one of the reasons I don't use the commercial leaders, is they start off at, 30-pound butt section or something? And if that stayed on your reel for a couple of days, it's hard to get that coil off of the commercial leader.
Okay. So you're a fan of mono and not fluorocarbon. And,
yep.
Okay. And no indicators. Boy, you're hardcore there, aren't you?
I won't say anything bad about fluorocarbon.
Yeah. You know, some of that stuff, it's what you get used to and, you know, and how you work with it and so forth. And
As for tying the pieces of monofilament together, use a modified surgeon's knot. And that won't cut on itself. And forging will just say it's a loop. You take the two ends of the leader, put it together. You make a loop. Behind it, you make another loop. You reach through when you pull both pieces out and tighten it up. Trim off the ends, and it's good to about 98% of the breaking test of the leader.
Yeah, it's a good, simple knot to use, definitely. Yep. Let's see. Let's talk about, you mentioned a few of the food sources. Now, up there in the Kamloops area, what are the primary food sources for the trout, and what's the most important one, do you think?
The most important one is Gomeris shrimp. It's a little freshwater shrimp. I don't know how widespread those bugs are, but if you get fairy shrimp or even maybe small crayfish, it will probably take the place of it. If you don't have the shrimp around, number one would be the chironomids, or midges, as people call them.
Okay.
And then probably the next one in line is the caddisfly, number three.
So when you're fishing, are you ever putting those together? I mean, you use a caddis pupa with a midge dropper or something like that?
We're not allowed to use dropper flies here.
Oh, that's right. It's one fly, right?
It's one fly.
Okay.
If you're fishing alone in a boat, you can have two rods out, but only one fly on each rod. No dropper flies.
Kind of hard to cast two rods
when
you're fly fishing. Yeah.
Sometimes the guys get a fish on each rod, and it's hard to land them both.
Yeah. Okay, so we know what the food source is, and in your case, you have to be dead on pretty much to get them. Terry in B.C., he's up in B.C. too, he says, what would be the fly patterns for searching that you would go to first and the best way to fish them?
Well, if you're searching, you probably drag it around the lake. I mean, if I go to a new lake and I'm not sure where the shoals are and everything, I'll throw on my intermediate sink and I fish out of a canoe and just slowly drag around a dock spratly or a halfback. Probably they're both attractor flies, but they look like enough bugs that you're bound to, if a fish is feeding on something, pick one up with one of those two flies.
What was the first one again?
Halfback or fullback.
Oh, fullback. Okay.
Yeah, fullback or halfback.
Yeah.
And Doc Spratley is a bigger attractor fly.
Oh, that's the one I was looking for, yeah. Okay. And so those are your searching flies. Good. And so probably the same answer. Al in Vancouver, B.C. asks, what are your go-to flies when there's no hatch coming off? So then we're back to searching, right?
Okay. Pretty much the searching flies. Plus, with shrimp being the number one food source, and they don't hatch, they might throw on a shrimp. And also, one when I'm not seeing much of a hatch is a dragonfly nymph. Those critters live in the lakes for about 4 years.
Do you get damsel flies up there, too?
Yeah, we get damsel flies as well.
Okay.
A little harder to fish with those.
Mm-hmm.
When they go through the water, they swim like a fish, and to try to imitate that motion, it's pretty difficult. Whereas the dragonfly tends to squirt along, and you can imitate it with your retriever, even dragging it behind a canoe.
Lauren in Victoria, B.C. asks, in the fall months, what are your most productive flies?
In the fall, most of the bugs have finished hatching, and new crops of bugs are starting along, like your damselflies or whatever. But the thing is, they're all small. In the fall, it's best to go to small bugs, small flies. We'll even go down to a number 16 or 18 midge, chironomid, and fish those up near the surface, near weed beds. So main suggestion is small flies in the fall months.
Okay. Yeah, you're still working with the same species and so forth. Just
yep.
Go down some sizes. Okay.
I just might finish a little bit more on that.
Sure.
Shrimp are best in the fall. They're the Gomeris shrimp. And you also get your bloodworms and water boatmen in the fall that you don't get too much of throughout the rest of the year.
Okay. Tim in Missoula, Montana, asks, where and when do you fish the traveler sedges?
The big traveler sedges, they peak about July 1st.
Okay.
And one of the best times, they hatch all day and all night. And the evening and night hatches are probably much larger than the daytime hatches. I mean, if you see 1,000 traveler sedges in the daytime, there will probably be 10,000 at night. So evening and night's probably one of the better times to fish them. And then, like I say, they peak around July 1st. They start as early as about June, first week in June, you might see some. And I can't remember how late they'll go in the year.
Now, did the trout get crazy over those? Are they?
Yeah, sedges, caddis, or whether they're travelers or not, they're about the number three food source. So, yeah, they're very important.
Okay.
Some people refer to the great big caddis. Other ones just refer to the movement of even a small caddis. They're calling them travelers because they scoot across the surface of the water, and often they're laying eggs in.
Okay. Okay. See, we've got a question on the Internet here. Steve in Ashcroft, B.C. He asks, warmer weather creates a lake with a strata of algae. sometimes lasting well into the fall. How do you confront the problems of fly fishing in a lake that is 3 feet thick with algae?
You fish underneath the algae. It tends to float. And I had some excellent fishing when there's a algae hatch on. You just have to get put on that intermediate sink or maybe even a faster sink line and get down a little deeper.
Okay, let's see here. A couple more here online. Richard in Alberta asks, what's your favorite fly pattern for rainbow and cam loops on still water?
Favorite fly pattern?
Yeah.
And it's a little invention of my own, which doesn't do anybody any good.
How can you describe it?
What it looks like mostly is a halfback, and I tie them in number 14s, number 16s, but it's got a fairly big abdomen. It's shaped more like a sedge pupa, which halfback will probably do much the same thing.
Okay. Phil in Utah says, where can I fish for cam loops close to Utah? I guess the closest we're going to get is BC, right?
Unless you got some very temperate conditions, yes.
Yeah. And got Richard in Alberta asks, do any of the stillwater lakes freeze over? And then is there ice fishing going on up there?
Yeah, around here, even the big lakes occasionally freeze over. But virtually every one of the smaller lakes will. And you have to check the regulations. Some lakes are open to ice fishing, others are not. It was interesting that in the World Fly Fishing Championships, I guided a New Zealand team. And they were asking me, how do the fish survive the winter? I'm trying to figure out what they meant. And what they thought was that the lake froze all the way to the bottom and the fish were actually frozen in the ice.
Come on, don't pick on the Kiwis like that.
They don't get enough ice down there to know what to do.
Yeah. You know, it's really kind of a valid question because I know a friend of mine here in Denver area, his expertise is building koi ponds. And you have to build those deep enough to where there's this little pocket where it's, you know, because koi ponds aren't that deep, you know, I mean, in your backyard kind of thing. So, you know, it has to be at a certain depth. I can't remember what it is, but to create that pocket down there, and then those koi just go down in there and basically just kind of, you know, just lay around, so to speak, during the winter and go into that kind of metabolism where they're, you know, they're not doing much and not consuming any food and kind of hibernation almost.
Yeah, being cold-blooded, they can go for a long time without food.
Yeah. Of course, you know, you don't want to kind of mess with them when they're at that stage, I don't think.
No.
You're going to hurt them, especially if you plan on releasing them. But we had Phil in Utah. Again, he was asking if we talked about rod sizes. We really didn't. What size rod and weight rod do you usually find most appropriate up there in Cam Loops?
Personally, I use a number 7 or a number 8.
Okay.
Mine's an old rod, and it's actually classified 7/8.
Okay.
But, the reason being, the higher the number on the rod, the bigger fish you can expect to land with it.
Right.
If you're fishing for, you know, little rainbow trout of 4, 5, 6 weight is fine. But if you're getting into a 10-pound rainbow, you want something that's got a little bit of heft to it.
Yeah.
And also, the heavier line, we get lots of wind out on the lakes. And the heavier line is a lot easier to cast in the wind. Mm-hmm. I fish from a canoe all the time, and if I didn't have that heavier line, I'd be having the line blow into me all the time.
Yeah.
But okay. I recommend, and probably number 7 is a good all-around line.
Good all-around. Okay. Well, we need to take another quick break. We'll be right back and talk with Ron Newman more about Kamloops Rainbows. Housatonic River Outfitters offers the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option to wade fishing trips or drifting the river with their guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, they offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing trips for warm water species. Please tour their website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services they offer in Connecticut and Massachusetts. They were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services and have the largest established guide service in New England. To learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters, go to their website at www.dryflies.com. That's www.dryflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Ron Newman about Kamloops Rainbows. If you'd like to ask Ron a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Another question in on the Internet, and Scott in Oklahoma again asks, what is the season up there, both regulatory and probably, you know, weather-wise, and is ice out a factor?
The first lake we get free of ice around here, again, I'm not talking the great big lakes, but the ones that we fly fish in, happens around April 1st, and right through probably late November is when you start getting freeze-up. So anytime in between, you can find a lake to fish around here.
Okay, so the regulations, open season that whole time.
Yeah, as long as the ice is off, you can fish them.
Okay, okay. All right. Okay, some more questions here, some strategies and tactic kind of questions. We got Pat Harrison in Laramie, Wyoming. He says, okay, I've never been to Kamloops, B.C. before, and I don't know anyone. I buy my license. What next? The fly shops might focus on locals in the know. What's your advice for a first-timer when it comes to lakes in the Kamloops area?
Well, I know Pat, and he does know somebody up here, but it's a good question. If you're going someplace and you haven't got a clue what's happening, it probably wouldn't hurt to get on the Internet and check out some of the local fishing folks. Here in B.C., there's one that's gofishbc.com, and they've actually even got a chat line where you could ask about a specific lake if anybody's been there lately. There's also anglersatlas.com, which will show you probably a map of the lake and tell you how to get into it. And then there's other sites like bcadventures.com. But do your research before you get to a place and check out the fishing regulations. Ask at the fly shops once you get here. Even when you get on a lake, you can check and ask somebody what fly to use and this kind of thing.
Okay. Rick Takahashi in Fort Collins. Rick was a guest speaker on our show in the past, and great midge fisherman Rick is. He says, planning a trip next summer to come fish Kamloops, what lakes and rivers do you recommend we fish if we have a week? In addition, what patterns would you recommend we tie? So he wants you to be a little bit more specific. Can you be more specific about lakes in the area? Or do you not
want to? Names of lakes that are good?
Yeah.
Roche Lake, Tunkwa Lake, Loch Lejeune. Some little higher elevation ones, Rossmore. Those are some good ones. A little one out of town, but you can't camp out of it, is Jocko Lake. It has all kinds of big fish in it. Just 20 minutes from town, but there's no camping or overnight staying there.
Okay. If you're not camping, is Kamloops the place to stay in that area?
From Kamloops, you can reach a lot of the lakes within an hour, hour, 15 minutes drive. So it depends upon what you're into, whether you're wanting a camping experience or wanting the comforts of home kind of thing and want to drive to the lake each day.
Okay. And Rick also asked about what patterns would you recommend he tie?
What time? Middle of the summer. Probably be a good time for a chronomid. Most people, that seems to be a favorite fly around here, chronomid and midge patterns. I would tend to have a caddisfly pattern of some sort, either dry, probably both dry and wet. Dragonfly really? Pattern by the major food sources, and you can't go wrong.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, we got a question here on Rod in Amarillo asked, what size shrimp are you tying up there? And does
probably
it vary during the time of year?
Probably a 14, size 14. I tend to tie them on the long shank.
Not a curved shank?
Straight shank.
Okay.
A lot of guys tie the shrimp in a resting position on the curved shank where it's sort of curled.
Yeah.
But when they're moving, if you're retrieving it through the water, they're actually uncurled and straight out. And I tend to tie them in that swimming position and actually do a retrieve on them.
Okay, okay.
Not a very fast retrieve, but a retrieve.
Okay, which leads right into our next question here. Matt in Kamloops asks, what are your techniques for fishing water boatmen, scuds, and bloodworms as far as line setup, depth, and retrieve?
Well, the other day I was fishing shrimp patterns on Campbell Lake, another lake for Rick.
Rick?
With a dry line. Mind you, mostly Campbell Lake's fairly shallow. I was in about 10 foot of water with a dry line and, again, a little bit of weight on the leader and picking up fish right on the bottom. But generally, you want to put on a sinking line of some sort, probably, again, that intermediate sink, and get down with them. Water boatmen, a good way to fish water boatmen is with a sinking line, probably intermediate sink, and actually tie up the water boatman as a dry fly. Throw out your line, let it sink, and as soon as it pulls that dry fly under the surface, then you start to retrieve, and the water boatman's actually going down. And they get a lot of strikes that way. And then you bring it across the bottom, and then again start it back up when it gets close to your boat.
Now, when you say retrieve, are you doing short?
Typically short little pulls, yeah.
Little pulls.
Water boatmen with big paddles, and they tend to sort of jerk through the water.
Okay.
Sometimes that paddling is fairly fast.
We had a question from Mark Sims in Seoul, Korea, was along these same lines of retrieve. So you had mentioned just a few minutes ago about retrieving the shrimp. Is there a certain technique you use there?
For the shrimp?
Yes.
For all these flies, most of them move very slow in the water, like the chronometer. The old saying is, if you think you're going slow enough, slow it down some more. And that tends to go pretty well with all of the flies. These are bugs. They're not minnows. And it's not like fishing a streamer fly. You've got to go real slow with them.
Okay.
Actually, the ladies in the area do really well because they have the patience to slow down like that.
Mm-hmm.
Men tend to get them a little impatient and start retrieving.
3-foot strips like they're down in the salt, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. So slow and steady, short little burst. Think of how that little animal would be swimming through the water and then try to duplicate that.
And do that a couple of times. If it doesn't work, try your slow and steady and then all of a sudden give it a fast one. Sometimes that little extra pull will entice the fish to take it.
Okay. A question from Mike in BC asks, when using wet chronomid technique targeting fish at depths of 50 feet plus, do you, one, anchor both bow and stern? In my experiencing, allowing the stern to swing and the wind is more productive. Second part of his question, you want to answer that one first?
Okay, if you're fishing chronomids 50 feet plus, I don't.
Okay.
I haven't got the patience to wait for any line to get down that far. And there's a problem in fishing real deep water like that in terms of the fish actually get the bends when you bring them up from that kind of depth.
Ah.
Okay. So if you're going to fish that deep, you've got to release a fish right away, let him get back down to 50 foot so he can decompress. But when I meant anchoring, most folks here use an anchor on the bow and stern.
Okay.
I'm in a canoe. And I can't go walking together in my canoe to get the two anchors down, so I just use one.
Okay.
But,
and then he asks, what is the best line to use, fast, sinking, clear, intermediate? I think you've already answered that. You're floating and you're intermediate clear, right?
Yeah, he said that the clear went up, you got a better catch rate on the clear.
Yeah.
I haven't found that. I found about the same success on the clear line as the normal fly line.
Okay, another question from Carl in Brooklyn, New York. Springtime fishing in a reservoir in New Jersey, I came across about 8 fish cruising the bank in a protected cove. They were doing this all day long for a couple of weeks and didn't appear to be eating. Does this sound like spawning behavior? Is there a certain way to approach spawning fish?
It could be spawning behavior, but even on our fishing regulations here, they encourage you not to fish for spawners.
Right.
If you've ever eaten a spawner versus a nice fresh fish, there's a tremendous difference. I've tried them. I can't eat a spawner. Their body chemistry is going through all kinds of changes, and I don't recommend eating the darn things.
Yeah.
If you're just after them for sport, again, I would recommend don't, because they're in a weakened state, and you're liable to just kill them.
Yeah.
If you're going to release them, kind of thing.
But you think that might have been some kind of spawning behavior?
It might be, yeah. But, in our local lakes, the fish will cruise the shores like that, even when they're not in the spawning mode.
Yeah.
You get a hunting pack that will, 5-6 fish, it'll just cruise along together.
Yeah. Nathan in Calgary, Alberta, asks, Ron, I recently purchased a small boat motor for lake fishing and I'm anxious to get into your area. I know the season must be winding down. How late is too late to come out? Would the fish be slowed down too much by early November? Is it important to leave them alone while they prepare for winter? Good question.
Shouldn't be slowed down too much by early November. The only problem is whether it gets too cold for us out there. The fish are cold blooded. They don't mind that cold water. And as far as preparing for winter, I don't think it bothers them too much to be caught and released that late in the season.
Yeah, it's cold enough to keep you off for fly fishing, but not cold enough to get one of those Canadian ice fishing huts out there yet.
No. We usually start getting snow and stuff around the end of October, so you're taking your chances in November.
Okay. Thomas in Redmond, Washington says, I do some rainbow fishing in mountaintop lakes in Utah and find the biggest challenge is weeds. The best fishing is near shore where weeds grow to the surface, increasing snag issues, and only good if they are taking at the surface. I can't pull a wet or a streamer through that. Any thoughts on that?
Try fishing with something other than a streamer. I assume it might be good on these lakes. I don't know. I mean, I assume the fish are insectivorous. And if you do that, you can put on a dry line, a short leader, with a little bit of, again, that deep weight or a swivel or something, just to take it down near the weeds. But that way you can very slowly bring it through along the edge of the weeds without actually hanging up in them. If a streamer's the only thing you can catch it on, I'm not sure what you can do to avoid the weeds if you have to use a sinking line.
Yeah, okay. Rod Rashears in Amarillo, Texas asked, what's the largest Kamloops rainbow that you have caught personally?
That I have personally caught?
Yeah.
8 pounds, 2 ounces, I guess.
8 pounds, 2 ounces. And do you know the length of that fish?
I can't remember, no.
Okay.
You know, when we're out on the lakes, you can always tell the American fisherman from the local fisherman. You hear somebody say, how long was that fish? 24 mm-hmm. inches or whatever. It's got to be an American. Locally, we always estimate in weight rather than length. Because you can get a 20-inch fish that one weighs 4 pounds and one weighs 6 pounds kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Big difference.
Skinny fish versus a
yeah.
hefty fish, yeah. I noticed how you said estimate weight. You know, see, when us Americans, we measure them, we're at least saying what the real measurement is. When you guys estimate the weight, well, you could be off by a pound, couldn't you?
I've got a good set of scales.
Okay.
And
I was just checking out that estimating, because, see, I have a friend, every time he estimated how long a fish was, it was always 2 inches shorter than what it really was. So I'm
well, the same happens with estimating the weight.
Okay.
You want to cut the size of your fish in half, get a good set of scales, and they'll weigh about half as much as you thought they did.
Okay, so in Canada, the same problem exists in estimating,
yes.
right? Yeah, okay. That's what I figured. Okay, Jerry in Surrey, BC asked, do the fish do anything different when a lake is in algae bloom? We just talked about algae, but
yep.
he says he was up at Rocher on Monday. There was a skim on the water. North half of the lake was like an oil slick.
Yep.
Is there anything you do different around that other than just fishing under? Or?
Algae floats. You should be able to fish flying underneath them.
Okay.
You get a little bit of algae on your line. But
Right.
And the okay. fish are there, and they'll still feed.
Okay, we got a couple more questions. Walt in Redding, California. He says, the last 5 years I fished Kamloops Lakes for 10 days in June and October. Last week my friend and I fished with our friend Carlos. He used to guide up on Roach Lake.
Yep, Roach Lake.
And we fished Friskin, and there was no wind, water dead flat. We saw fish working the shallow part of the shoals, tails, and bubbles. Using a floating line with greased 20-foot leaders down to 4X with small scuds, bloodworms, chironomids, no success. We moved to other parts of the lake and used sinking lines, small attractors with little success. What would you have done different other than go home? By the way, I bought your book and use it.
I would have probably gone home. When the wind is totally calm, I don't know, well, again, the business with the eyes on the fish, but it's often hard to catch fish.
Yeah, yeah.
And you might go sit on the shore and watch the dragonflies fly by until a breeze comes up. When they're not biting, there's not an awful lot you can do. They're, one of the sensory things with the fish is they tend to get excited at unusual movement or contrast in their environment. And you can put on a sinking line and try a fish that's got, a fly that's got, say, black and white color, a high contrast, and maybe even a hackle on it, because that'll put out vibrations in the water. And try some strips through the water fairly fast sometimes.
Yeah, yeah.
You're just trying different methods to see if you can get them interested. But when the fish are off, there's not an awful lot you can do.
Yeah. One final question here. John Kent, Fox Creek, Alberta. He says, I managed Tunkwa Lake Resort from 2000-2008. During that time, I quite often referenced the map you made, which was on the display at the entrance to the lodge. My question is, how has the chemistry and dynamics of the lake changed in the past 30 years? And what do you think the negative or positive effects on the lake will be now that it's been open to ice fishing? There you go.
I don't know how the chemistry has changed. But I know that the more people that are using the lake, it tends to get a little bit polluted. And Tunkwa Lake used to have really big fish, really nice fish, and they usually catch a 5-pounder plus out of Tunkwa. These days, you're lucky to get 3-4 pounders.
Okay.
So something has happened up there. Whether it's ice fishing or the lake chemistry or something else, maybe too heavy a stocking rate, I don't know. But yes, the size of the fish has been reduced to Tunkwa.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, we're out of time, so we need to wrap things up here. And we still need to give away some prizes, a one-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a one-year subscription to Fly Fishing Magazine and a copy of Ron's book, Rainbow Trout Fly Fishing, courtesy of Amato Books. So stay with us here, folks, for just a bit longer, and we'll get those prizes chosen here for the participants. So I want to talk again with you about Casting for Recovery. Casting for Recovery provides fly fishing retreats for women who have had or have breast cancer and at no cost to the participants. Well, Casting Recovery, they have these retreats and so forth, and they've entered themselves into a contest, and they're a contender for the Pepsi Refresh Grant, which is a $250,000 prize, basically, that the organization will get to do their great work. And we've put all the information on our homepage for Casting Recovery. If you'll go there, it's real simple. You can either text or go to the website or to Facebook, three different ways where you can vote. It costs you nothing. There's no obligation. Just vote every day if you can this month. This is the last month that they're running for this contest, and I think if they get in first or second place, they will have a chance at winning this prize. So help the ladies out over there, Casting Recovery, and see if we can earn some money for them for their retreats. We'd all appreciate that. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage on the section of tonight's show that says, what did you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Well, now it's time to give away our prizes. So let's see here. We're going to do our drawings first. First for the Federation of Fly Fishers membership, one-year membership in that organization. It's a great organization to be a member, and they do all kinds of great things, conservation and also educational as well. And if you want to find out more about the Federation, go to fedflyfishers.org, fedflyfishers.org. So our winner for that membership is Kemper Eagle. Kemper Eagle, and Kemper is in Virginia. So congratulations, Kemper. We'll get that information out to you and send you an email and get that going for you. So if you've already got a membership, we'll get that extended for you as well. So congratulations. And now we'll do the drawing for the one-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine and another great periodical that has great articles and great photography in it and lots to learn from it. And that winner is going to be Jerry Davis. Jerry Davis in Montana. So congratulations, Jerry, on that subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. Those of you that didn't win, go to flyfusionmag.com and check them out. They're doing an electronic version now, too, of their magazine, flyfusionmag.com. Okay, now let's give away Ron's book here and clear my queue here. I'm going to make it easy on him tonight, Ron. Sometimes I give him a hard one. Sometimes I just feel like giving him the easy one tonight.
Okay.
But I'm checking now to see if any... We've got some wise guys out there that try to answer the question before I ask it.
Do they ever
say? So I'm checking now to see. I still haven't asked the question. I already got one answer, so we've disqualified that one. Okay, so here it goes. Ron said the most important food source in the Kamloops Lakes area for our rainbow trout, Kamloops rainbows, is what? Okay, now we'll wait and see. Oh, might have got it right off the bat here, Ron. He says Gomeris shrimp.
That's correct.
Can't get any closer than that, can you?
That's right on the button.
That'd be Silas Gray and Joplin. Silas, you just won Ron's book. You're going to enjoy this, buddy, because it's chock full of all kinds of information, and Ron has just done a tremendous amount of research over the past 30 years, so I know you're going to enjoy it. And if other people would like to get Ron's book, they can do that at Amato or on Amazon, right, Ron?
Yes.
Okay. So check that out. Again, Ron's book is Rainbow Trout Fly Fishing. Rainbow Trout Fly Fishing. So check it out. I know you all enjoy it. Well, Ron, we really appreciate you being on the show again and enjoyed talking with you about Kamloops rainbows, and we learned a lot, and obviously there's a lot more to learn as well. By reading your book, I realize we just touched the surface of this.
We've just touched the surface. We didn't get too much into the sensory perceptions or...
Yeah. So, like I said, 90 minutes goes by quick, and we're done with that, and I appreciate you being on the show.
Well, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
You're all great. Glad to have you. Our next podcast will be on November 3rd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. And on that show, we're going to interview Kirk Dieter. And our topic for the show is going to be tips and tricks that will make you a better fly fisher. On this show, Kirk Dieter will answer those nagging questions you always wanted to know about fly fishing for trout, including casting, presentation, bugs, reading water, and more. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Front Range Anglers, Royal Gorge Anglers, and Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. That's 1-800-985-1673, extension 8. And we'll be happy to explain the options available to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.